wool or scarf, maybe a battered swaddling cloth. Then I realized. Froze. Felt dizzy. Its similarity to Erzabet's was unmistakable. I should look at that more closely, I thought. I should reach for it. Yes, I'll reach for it. My limbs would not obey me. I watched my own hands carefully close the lid of the chest. I stood up and left the room very quickly, as if propelled by an external force, shuttering the light behind me. I sat on the top stair, staring into the darkness until I was sure even Frank had gone to sleep.
Diachronicle. Days 295 to 304. Late May, Year 1. In which there isn't enough magic to go around. The next day, we return to the Odek to begin a more sophisticated series of experimentations. Rebecca East Oda made it clear that she felt Oda-sensei's involvement in the project had reached the end of its natural course, and so neither of them returned with us. We were to essentially sequester ourselves for a fortnight as Erzabet eased back into the habit of performing magic and displayed her skills for us. Although we were free to leave the building to eat, exercise, take the air, even to return to my apartment occasionally to shower, Erzabet and I would sleep in the Odek room. Tristan was already happily ensconced in his bachelor pad of an office. By the time we arrived that first morning, the Maxes had brought in camp cots, towels and linens, a couple of well-fed lab rats and lab rat grub, a case of old tear sheet best bitter for Tristan, toothbrushes and toothpaste. Oh, God, I'd barter my body for a tube of Crest now. Cleaning my teeth with a paste of borax and ground cuttlefish bones, with anise to sweeten it? Ugh. And as many breakfast groceries and snacks as the college dorm-style refrigerator in the upstairs office could hold. There were also several boxes of seemingly random props from a list that Tristan had texted the Maxes the night before. As soon as they'd set up our bunker, the Maxes packed up and moved on, presumably to their next shadowy government assignment. They took all but one of the Vladimirs with them. We still had a full complement of Lukes to guard the building and assure our security, but they were otherwise useless. The days that followed were long ones, the takeout food we lived on relatively tasteless. By 21st century standards, context really is everything. And by night, we were each too tired even for conversation. Tristan in particular was worn down and preoccupied. My memories of that time are drab and bleary, despite the remarkable nature of our undertakings. The first week's experiments, dictated by Tristan, included manifesting inanimate objects, both those occurring in nature, e.g. sticks and stones, and those man-made, e.g. a cap gun, or at least something resembling one. Changing the chemical composition of liquids, e.g. water to salt water, moving small things, e.g. the manifested cap gun, from one spot in the Odek to another. The array of requests evolved over the days from the mundane, turn this sweater inside out, to the fanciful, turn this vanilla ice cream into Rocky Road, to the creepy, animate the stuffed cat, to the startling, turn this lab rat into a newt. Erzabet was willing to show off her powers, although after a day or two of adjusting to having them back, she made it very clear that she found the assignments themselves tiresome and stupid. She would, she informed us, perform magic because it pleased her to do so after so many years deprived of it. She would not perform it simply because Mr. Tristan Lyons required it of her. She was flexing a muscle she'd longed to flex for many scores of years, and to a certain degree she was preening. Once the buzz of that wore thin, we knew she would feel no obligation to continue the dog and pony show. Tristan did not waste breath explaining to either of us what his higher-ups were expecting from this sequestration. I just took his lead, trying to learn as much as we could about Erzabet's powers, although it was a trying undertaking. Erzabet herself had cast us as good cop, bad cop, and it was natural enough to play those roles. Tristan pushed her, I cajoled. He made her feel significant. I made her feel appreciated. Truth be told, after 3 days of it, His job proved far easier than mine. For she was, to use a post-Victorian turn of phrase, high maintenance. Other than her attitude, our biggest headache was that obviously we could not tape or photograph what she was doing in the ODEC. We could not be in there with her without blacking out. She had to thump on the door just to let us know she was finished with each spell. Our only recourse for research, therefore, was for me to interview her after each exercise. Since she would not answer Tristan's questions, or rather, answered them, but only with gratuitous derision, he divided his time between measuring and studying whatever objects she'd worked her magic on, and hourly emailing his bosses at the shadowy government entity regarding our progress. Apparently, the Maxis had delivered glowing reports on the results of Erzabet's first spell, and it seemed the bosses wanted everything she did to be as attention-grabbing as she herself now was. Erzabet, in these interviews with me, was not illuminating. Here follows almost verbatim, as I can remember it, the gist of an early attempt. Upon the occasion of Erzabet taking my sweater into the ODEC with her and changing it from green wool to lavender polyester, which took much longer than we expected, an entire afternoon, and left her strangely exhausted. N.B. Yes, Tristan had specific reasons for such peculiar and frivolous-seeming instructions. Mel. Can you explain to me how you did this? Erzabet. Pa. I found where you were wearing lavender polyester and brought that here. It was hard to find. There are not many opportunities to find you owning polyester. Mel. The physicist would say that in some parallel reality to this one in the multiverse, there is a Mel wearing a lavender polyester sweater. Erzabet makes her dismissive face and shrugs to make it clear she doesn't give a fuck. Doesn't care what physicist would say. Mel. What we want to understand is, how does it end up here in this reality, and what happens to the original sweater? Erzabet. I summon it here and get rid of the other one. Mel. How, though? By what mechanism? Erzabet. The same way you do anything. You do what causes the desired result. If you want something to burn, you set it on fire. If you want something to be wet, you pour liquid on it. If you want something that is upstairs to be downstairs, you send someone to collect it. It is exactly the same, except it is more complicated to calculate what to do. For example, in that metaphor, what route to tell the servant to take upstairs, how fast to move, and so on. Mel. But can you explain technically, mechanically, not metaphorically, what you are doing and how you do it? Erzabet. Pa. If you don't understand a perfectly simple explanation, then you are too stupid to understand a more technical one. Mel. Fine. Can you at least explain to me why some people can perform magic and others can't? Erzabet. This is like asking why doesn't a blind person know what blue smells like? And thus went all interviews. There are transcripts of 24 such on that original laptop. They are probably now either archived or expunged. If I don't escape from 1851 within the next 3 weeks, I will never know which. Further, Erzabet was capricious, and she knew she held all the power. We were demanding something of her. Quite a lot of something, to be fair, while there was nothing we could offer her in recompense. Her greatest desire was fulfilled by circumstance. As a 19-year-old bombshell, she would never be reincarcerated in the retirement home. She had other desires, but expressed them only erratically at first. Most significantly, on our 12th day in seclusion, when we had stopped for lunch, she announced she wished to go to Hungary to spit upon the graves of my enemies.
We don't have the budget, said Tristan,
and took a bite of his tuna sandwich. He had said nothing about it, but his mysterious revenue stream seemed to be drying up. Deliveries of liquid helium were fewer and further between, and seemed to involve his spending a lot of time in exhausting phone conversations. He kept having to call Frank Oda in to help debug the ODEC, which I could see he felt bad about since Frank wasn't getting paid. And he kept pressing our Lukes and our Vladimir into service, doing things that, to judge from the looks on their faces, weren't in their job descriptions. Tristan had always suffered from a certain ADHD-ness, which was alternately charming and exasperating.
His phone had lately been going off every few minutes, which made this even worse. He'd programmed it to produce different ringtones and vibrate patterns for different incoming callers, so he could tell without even looking at it who was bothering him. One of those was a snatch of John Philip Sousa's Liberty Bell March. It was typical American patriotic bombast, military parade stuff. Overlaid on that was a whole different set of associations based on the fact that it was the theme song for Monty Python's Flying Circus. Every so often I would hear it coming out of Tristan's phone. When it did, he would drop what he was doing and visibly snap to attention and take that call without delay, hurrying off to a quiet part of the building and saying, "Sir," and "Yes, sir," a lot. Obviously, this was the ringtone he'd assigned to his boss. What I didn't know, and what I was dying to ask, was its meaning. Was Liberty Bell March just a snatch of patriotic music to him? Or a wry allusion to an absurdist British comedy show that had been canceled before he had been born? We were in the office just outside the ODEC, at the small table where I usually interviewed Ersebet. I had been about to suggest we repair outside to stroll down to the Charles, perhaps even drive to Walden Pond for some fresh air and sunshine. It was Memorial Day weekend in New England, and we were living, working, and sleeping in a basement under fluorescent lights. I mean, really, WTF. Often I still wonder how things would be different now if I had pressed for such a constitutional. Surely in some other, better universe. Mel made that suggestion, and so the trio left the building and was not there when General Schneider arrived. But in our universe, the trio stayed in the basement, having this conversation.
"If you cooperate with us,"
Tristan continued, swallowing his bite of tuna salad,
"we can probably get funding. And then if you really want to go spit on the graves of your enemies, we can discuss it."
And then, putting down his sandwich, eyes lighting up,
"Wait a minute. We can get our own funding. If you can change water to salt water, why not change
lead to gold?"
she said with him, with an adolescent groan of disapproval.
"Or anything to gold. That is the most unoriginal suggestion in the world. From the dawn of magic, this is the first thing people ask of witches."
"And?"
prompted Tristan.
"We don't do it," she said. "Obviously."
"Why not?"
"Ask the fuckers."
"What?"
Tristan and I exclaimed in unison. Erzabeth had many disagreeable traits, but use of vulgar language was most certainly not one of them. She was taken aback by our reaction.
"The fuckers," she said. "You know, the fuckers."
Tristan and I looked at each other as if to verify we'd both heard it. Ersebet laughed in a way that suggested she wasn't really all that amused.
"You people have such dirty minds. It is a perfectly normal German name. Maybe you spell it F-U-G-G-E-R, just to be polite."
"Oh," I said, "Fugger, as in the old German banking family."
"As in them, yes."
"So, back to where we were,"
Tristan said, shaking his head.
"You're saying we should ask some old dead German bankers why you don't change lead into gold?"
"They are not all dead,"
Ersebet corrected him.
"If you go down to the financial district, you can probably find one right now, sitting in a nice discreet office."
"Well," I said, "obviously bankers would have something to say about changing lead into gold."
"They would not like it," Ersebet said.
And this was the first time I ever got the sense from her that she actually cared whether someone else would or wouldn't like a thing. She considered fuggers, or fuckers, as she pronounced the name, people to be reckoned with.
"Let's try a different example if you don't like gold,"
Tristan said.
"I'm going to show my cards a little bit more than I usually do."
And he pocketed his phone, which he'd been looking at under the table, and laid both hands on the table's upper surface, as if literally showing his cards.
"To hell with gold. Could you produce enriched uranium?"
She considered it.
"The stuff they use in bombs?"
"The stuff they use in bombs."
She shook her head.
"Certainly not. This would cause too much change too quickly, and bad things happen when magic is used that way.
What bad things?
Bad things, she said with finality. Worse than your nooks. We don't even have words to describe them, so we don't do that.
Then there are rules, I said, opening the laptop to take notes. Not changing things too quickly is a rule. What are some other rules?
There is no rule, she said. We just don't do it. Is there a rule telling you not to jump off a cliff? No, but you don't do it.
What else don't you do? Asked Tristan. What a ridiculous question, she said.
To me,
he only asks ridiculous questions. I hope he is not your lover, because he is not worthy.
Why is it a ridiculous question? Pressed Tristan.
Can you tell me all the things you would not do?
No.
You only know what not to do when you're faced with the prospect of doing it. It's like that with everything, including magic.
Can you give me some examples?
He asked with exaggerated patience. She looked thoughtful, and for a happily deluded moment, we both thought she was going to be cooperative.
I am tired of doing all the giving, she said.
So,
your turn to give me something. You will give me a cat.
After a confused pause, I asked, as a pet?
No, as a cat, she said.
A live cat? Asked Tristan.
Of course a live cat. What would I do with a dead cat?
Okay, you can have a cat, said Tristan indulgently. We'll get you a cat next week. As soon as you've done something, we can show the brass.
I will show the brass something after you give me a cat, she corrected triumphantly.
Ersebet, I said in a friendly, intimate tone, we have no time to go fetch you a cat or litter box or any of the other stuff a cat needs. But if you would like to be employed again by powerful people who can give you as many cats as you like, then please cooperate with us for the next few days. She pursed her lips and glanced between the two of us.
Put me in touch with those people you speak of. Why am I wasting my time doing stupid tricks for minions?
Because these minions have an Odek,
said Tristan abruptly and openly irritated.
Without this Odek, you are nothing. And this Odek is ours, so play nice.
She gave him a furious, disgusted look.
I want to be very clear with you about something, she said in a warning tone. There are many novels in which there is a handsome man and a beautiful woman, and they argue all the time and are at odds and constantly clash, and it is because, secretly, they want to make passionate love to each other. That is not the case here.
At this, Tristan let out a huge guffaw, a rumbling, raucous belly laugh, head thrown back.
I am serious, she protested hotly.
I am so glad you clarified that,
he said, huffing with laughter.
Because, I gotta tell you, with General Schneider breathing down my neck to learn what your magic is good for, with my spending every free waking moment trying to convince him and his bosses that this is useful, even if you haven't already materialized enriched uranium for them, I gotta tell you, when I am so totally preoccupied with your being seen as a valued commodity that the time it takes me to shave feels like a personal overindulgence, I love knowing that your number one priority is devaluing me even more than my bosses want to devalue you. That's awesome. You're the best. I'll be so fucking devastated when they pull the plug on this and you end up in the street without even a nursing home to take care of you.
He stood up and stormed to the far side of the room, his hands at his temples.
Jesus!
Then he turned back toward us and said from a distance,
I apologize. That was totally uncalled for, and I should have more control over myself. It's been a tough week.
They want to pull the plug?
Said Ersebet, scandalized. How long has that been true? I asked, shocked. He ran his hands through his short hair a few times, roughly, and then returned to sit by us again.
Almost from the word go,
he confessed, pained.
General Schneider was excited for about 30 minutes, And then he and Dr. Rudge wanted immediate gratification. They wanted her to start manifesting stealth bombers or teleport invisibly to Syria, that sort of thing.
This was the first time he had mentioned names. Until then, Tristan had maintained impeccable secrecy concerning his chain of command. Either he really was at the end of his rope, or else he thought he could gain Ersebet's trust by personalizing the discussion. If so, it wasn't working.
"And instead, you had me turning sweaters inside out," demanded Ersebet in disgust. "And you wonder why they do not value me. You are more of an idiot even than I thought."
"Every task I gave you was a beta test for something else that would have obvious military use. They want you to turn a person inside out. Obviously, I have to test that on a sweater and not a person or even on a lab rat. And, of course, I'll fulfill their agenda, but ideally, I'd like to exceed it. I've got more scruples than they do, so I'd like to present you to them, brand you, so to speak, as being useful for something other than turning a person inside out."
"Such is?"
"Turning lead into gold would be pretty awesome,"
he said, sounding wistful. She shook her head.
"Why don't you suggest something, then?"
he said to her.
"Given that you can only work your magic inside the ODAC, you're a little limited, you realize that?"
"She can turn rats into newts," I reminded him.
"So can your average kid's birthday party magician."
"Not for real." "Anyhow, what about a person?" I said. "What if I let her turn me into a newt?"
"I would not turn a person inside out, probably,"
Ersebet informed Tristan.
"That would be tasteless. You Americans are so tasteless."
"Turn me into a newt," I insisted. "The bosses will like that." And that, as I recall, was the moment when Tristan's phone began playing the Liberty Bell March. He pulled it out of his pocket and double-taked, then used his finger to scroll down.
"Snap inspection,"
he announced, looking up to make eye contact with me and Ersebet.
"Shine your shoes and polish your belt buckles."
Diachronicle, Day 304, in which General Schneider is impressed. No more than 5 minutes later, we were joined by a broad-chested gentleman in uniform, trailed by a younger man, similarly attired, whose sole purpose in life seemed to be to open doors for, and to hold the hat of, the boss. At the time, I knew nothing of uniforms, rank, or insignia. A few years later, having spent a lot of time around active-duty military, I'd have been able to recognize this man as a brigadier general, one star, and his aide as a lieutenant colonel. Both were wearing dress uniforms, the military world equivalent of business suits. Conveniently, they were wearing nameplates on their right breast pockets, so I knew that their last names were Schneider and Ramirez even before Tristan made introductions, which he did with even more than his accustomed level of military crispness. General Schneider moved about the room in an asymmetrical gait, shaking first my hand, then Ersebet's. His manner was extraordinarily grim and formal. He paid only cursory attention to me. Then his gaze settled on Ersebet, taking her in head to foot, and for a fleeting moment he looked impressed. But then he frowned and turned his attention to Tristan.
"I assume that's the asset,"
he said, pointing.
"Pointing is very rude," said Ersebet.
Tristan hastily said,
"General Schneider, yes, Miss Carpathy is the one I told you about."
"This must be the one who wishes me to turn people inside out," said Ersebet,
looking away with wounded dignity.
"Very tasteless."
Schneider gave her a strange look, but then returned his attention to Tristan, who said quickly,
"You came at a great time, sir. We were just in the middle of a very productive conversation. You said a couple of weeks, Major Lyons. In my dictionary, a couple means two. It has been two. General Schneider, you're not doing what we discussed, Major Lyons. You're going off script. You're giving us a science project." "Sir, I explained in my report," Tristan began.
But Ersebet talked over him.
"My powers are so little to a man who requires an assistant just to walk into a room."
"She was just about to turn me into a newt," I offered urgently. General Schneider gave me a look, and then turned condescendingly to her.
Yeah, I've been hearing about the newt thing all week. That might have been impressive 1,000 years ago.
I was born in 1832. I was not alive 1,000 years ago, she retorted. If you cannot grasp simple arithmetic, then you will never have any idea what Mr. Tristan Lyons is trying to accomplish here.
Schneider continued speaking over her.
Those kinds of tricks are nothing in a world with drones, cruise missiles, and assault rifles. And according to Major Lyons's reports, it takes you all day to pull it off. By the time you get that spell half out of your mouth, I can rack around into my sidearm and put it between your eyes.
Do you need your minion to help you with that, too?
She asked. He looked back over his shoulder at Lieutenant Colonel Ramirez.
Have a look around the facility,
he said. Ramirez departed wordlessly.
I liked the Maxis better, Ersebet announced.
Did you get my point?
General Schneider demanded.
If you want the taxpayers of the United States to go on subsidizing your beauty treatments, you'd better impress me. Now, today, right now.
Very well, then,
purred Ersebet, so immediately cheerful that my skin prickled. I glanced at Tristan. He was looking at her keenly, and not in the usual slack-jawed way that men would look at such a woman. Ersebet stood and gestured to the open door of the Odek, smiling like a 1950s housewife on a television advertisement.
If you would like to step inside, General, I will demonstrate the kind of magic you desire. In fact, I would be delighted to give you what you're asking for.
General?
Said Tristan tentatively.
Good,
said General Schneider, all too obviously charmed by Ersebet's physical endowments. I got the clear sense that in his world, he dealt with a lot of submissive women who thought of nothing but pleasing him.
That's what I was after, Major Lyons. Why did it take me coming all the way up here to get that kind of compliance? Where's the whatever it is I have to wear?
In that corner, I said, gesturing toward the rack of snowmobile suits. Tristan respectfully asked to speak in private with Schneider. They stepped into the server room for a moment, and I could hear Tristan's voice trying to explain something, and the general's interrupting him. The door opened suddenly, and Schneider limped back in, rolling his eyes. I handed him the snowsuit, and then gestured with my head for Ersebet to step aside with me. She joined me by the console panel, and, an occasional habit of hers, like a nervous tic, reached into her bag and riffled through it without looking at what she was doing. Don't turn him inside out, I said. She looked insulted.
Of course not. Blood, body fluids all over my dress?
You know what I mean. Don't hurt him. You said you owed me a debt of gratitude. I'll consider it fulfilled if you promise me that. She smiled innocently, which filled me with a sense of dread.
I promise. I am not going to hurt him.
And then, grinning as broadly as she had her first day with us, she stopped fidgeting with the things in her bag, marched into the Odek with her dress flouncing about her, and waited for Schneider. Meanwhile, Schneider zipped and velcroed himself into the largest of our snowmobile suits. Schneider was hefty, and the suit was tight. I noticed something that explained his rolling, asymmetrical style of walking. He had one artificial leg.
Give us 15 minutes, please.
Ersebet called out to Tristan, as Schneider squeezed into the Odek with her.
To impress the general, we'll require some effort.
We closed the door, and Tristan walked to the control console to turn on the Odek. There was, of course, no way we could know what was going on inside the Odek. That was an unavoidable part of the whole Schrödinger's cat thing. But after 11 minutes, we heard the thump on the door that told us Ersebet was finished. Tristan went to the console and powered down the Odek. I slipped on the oven mitts that we used whenever we wanted to touch the dangerously cold door latches and opened the door.
And so, said Ersebet,
radiant and fresh-faced, her tone sparkling.
I have shown your master a magic trick.
She walked out into the room, leaving the coast clear for us to see inside. And what we saw, or thought we saw, was the motionless body of General Schneider, crumpled on the floor.
General Schneider!
Tristan exclaimed, and stepped in through the door. There wasn't enough room in there for me to join him, so I contented myself with sticking my head in for a look. Schneider wasn't actually there. Collapsed on the floor, apparently empty, was the snowmobile suit. An empty oxygen mask was still lodged in its hood.
"Where is he?"
Tristan demanded, horrified. "Did you turn him into a newt?" I asked. She examined her fingernails.
"Oh, no, it takes me all day to pull that off."
Tristan picked up the suit and held it upright. One of the legs fell straight down as if weighted with something and clanked onto the floor of the Odek. "Give it to me," I suggested, and reached through the doorway. He thrust the shoulders of the suit at me. I grabbed them and pulled the whole thing out through the door and into the room, where I laid it out flat on the floor. Left behind in the Odek was an articulated contraption consisting of a stump cup, some straps, and a carbon fiber strut, terminating in a man's dress shoe, Schneider's artificial leg. I unzipped the front of the snowmobile suit with some care. I had an idea as to what had happened. Somewhere inside of this bulky garment was a living, breathing newt. I needed to find it, catch it, and return it safely to the Odek, where Erzsébet could reverse the spell. No harm done. Point made. Inside the suit was an empty suit of clothes. Shirt buttoned, tie knotted, sleeves of the shirt fitted into the sleeves of the jacket. But no person. Tristan had emerged from the Odek, carrying the artificial leg in one hand, and Schneider's remaining shoe, sock dangling from it, in the other. I grabbed the oxygen mask and pulled it carefully away from the snowsuit's hood. A little gleaming cascade of glinting objects fell out of it, followed by a pair of fake teeth, held together by a bridge of pink plastic. That gave me a clue as to the little gleaming things. They were tiny bits of curiously shaped metal. They were fillings from Schneider's teeth. Groping carefully through Schneider's jacket and shirt, Tristan's hand found something. He unbuttoned the garments and spread them apart. Exposed in the middle, resting neatly on the back of the white shirt, was a small, smooth object with a couple of wires coming out of it.
"That," Tristan said, "is a pacemaker."
I couldn't even speak properly, so I held up my hand with the fillings and the false teeth for Tristan to look at. Tristan was squatting on his haunches. He looked at these exhibits for a while, thoughtfully. Acting on some kind of military guy autopilot, he rummaged in Schneider's clothes until he came out with a small pistol, which Schneider had evidently been packing in a holster on the back of his belt. Tristan ejected its magazine and then worked the slide once to eject a round. Having rendered the weapon safe, he set it back down again, then climbed to his feet and turned to face Erzsébet.
"What have you done to him?"
Tristan demanded, very calm.
"Google it,"
said Erzsébet breezily.
"Google what?"
She put her index finger to her chin and looked up at the ceiling.
Hungary. Nadibjörgjörni, 1564. One-legged man naked. Perhaps Taltosh. You might discover something interesting."
"Stokes,"
said Tristan irritably. I grabbed my laptop, brought up Google, and typed in the words. Nothing useful came up.
"Well?"
demanded Tristan. I shook my head.
"Try refreshing," said Erzsébet. "Perhaps it takes a moment for it to catch up."
"Catch up with what?"
Tristan demanded.
"With me," she said,
and began humming Liszt to herself. I opened another window and tried Googling the Hungarian words she'd used. Nagybjörgyarn turned out to be the name of a village. Taltos, I already knew. It meant something like warlock. I went back to the first window and clicked the refresh button. Tristan came around to my side of the table and stared over my shoulder. Erzsébet preened. I refreshed the page a second time. "Nothing," I said.
"Try variations,"
she suggested, turning away as if in a reverie.
"Amputee, gibberish."
"Where is he?"
Tristan demanded again. I refreshed the page again. One search result came up. "There's a Wikipedia entry," I said. What the? Tristan muttered as I clicked on the link.
I made it into Wikipedia, sang Elizabeth. I'll bet none of my enemies ever made it into Wikipedia.
The page came up, entitled Najbjörnsjörn, Warlock Incident, containing a short paragraph with one notification saying the entry was a stub and encouraging us to help them supplement it, and a second saying the article needed additional citations for verification. The paragraph itself read, In 1564, in the small village of Najbjörnsjörn, a naked one-legged man is recorded as having materialized in the middle of a small lane, babbling in an unknown tongue. The townspeople were weary from a recent outbreak of typhus and on edge from years caught between the warring armies of the Ottoman Empire and Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian II. Once they recovered from their astonishment, the villagers bound the man and dragged him to the town square with the intent of burning him at the stake. This was prevented by the local priest of St. Ishvan, who instead caused him to be taken to the dungeon of the Inquisition. The priest examined and interrogated him for several hours, but was unable to make sense of a word of the man's foreign gibberish. The local mob, by now in a frenzy, finally broke in, dragged the man out, and burned him to death. I leapt to my feet. We stared in horror at the entry.
What have you done?
Tristan cried, practically leaping toward her. He grabbed her by the shoulders and shook her.
You killed him!
She struggled against him.
Unhand me! I did not kill him! The mob did! It says so right in Wikipedia!
I'll bite you if you don't let me go! What did you do?
He demanded, his voice sounding strangled, but then released her. She shrugged, adjusting her dress.
I sent him back to 1564. This is all I did. What happens once I send him is his responsibility.
Time travel, I said, hesitantly. You can send people back in time.
People can be moved to other strands, she corrected me. It is usually just a parlor trick, but sometimes it is useful to get somebody's attention.
How much control do you have over it?
Tristan demanded, thinking fast.
Can you bring him back here before the crowd gets to him?
She shook her head.
No, because I am not there with him. If he had asked a witch in Najbjörnsjörn politely, then she could have sent him back here.
Why didn't you mention you could do this? I asked, trying pathetically to reap some useful research out of the situation. In truth, we should have known. It was in a couple of the translated documents, but always dismissed as being of minor significance. She shrugged her dismissive shrug.
It is not a practical skill, and there are so many variables to contend with that it is of no practical use. It is seldom worth the bother.
You just murdered someone,
Tristan said.
I just sent him away, she protested. He was very rude to me.
That's bullshit. You sent him there knowing he could die. You had control over a situation that resulted in a man's death. How is that not murder?
There is never control when magic is involved, she replied philosophically.
Tristan was nearly hyperventilating.
Moments ago, he was in this room, and now he's dead. How is that not at least manslaughter?
He was going to shut the Odek down, she said. I had to stop him.
You could have just turned him into a newt or something, I said.
You already know I can do that, said Elizabeth,
preening again.
I wanted to show you something new.
To Tristan,
isn't that what you asked for? Something unexpected? To, what was your phrase? To brand me.
This is a fucking catastrophe,
Tristan shouted, and kicked a chair. It tumbled across the room to the far wall, where the seat busted apart from the legs.
Fuck!
He was so disagreeable, said Elizabeth.
Tristan put his hands on his face and shuddered.
How the fuck am I ever gonna explain this to... Oh, Jesus Christ, you ruined everything! Your own life! Do you understand that? That's it. It's over. You're done. We're done here.
He was pacing wildly and kept making the same anxious gesture of throwing his hands to either side, as if he'd just walked into a spider web and were trying to free himself of the gossamer.
I mean it, he said after a moment of silence. Leave. Stokes, get out of here before you get embroiled in all of this. Leave her here.
I am no coward. I would not flee, said Erisabet haughtily.
That's right. You're going to prison, he said flatly.
That will be more interesting than the nursing home, she replied, unfazed.
Or I might just shoot you myself, he said, suddenly weary.
He uprighted the chair he'd destroyed, discovered it was broken, sat down on the floor. Erisabet, perversely, looked delighted with this declaration.
Now you are speaking like a man of action. I have not seen such a sight of you before. I approve of it.
I mean it, Stokes,
he said. His voice was husky.
Just get out of here. I've got to tell them what happened.
He put his hands over his face and began to mutter the phrases he would soon be typing into a report.
Diachronic effects confirmed. Results unpredictable. Casualties. 1 KIA.
Diachronic, meaning through time. Department of Diachronic something?
Go ahead and fetch his minion. I will send him somewhere nicer,
Erisabet offered.
And then we can all pretend they never arrived and just go back to what we were doing. Only now we will do more interesting things, yes?
Tristan pressed the heels of his hands hard against his closed eyes and groaned.
Shut up, he said. Stokes, go. Really.
Go where? I asked. He moved his hands away from his eyes.
Just get out of town, let me deal with this. Somehow. I'll let you know when it's safe to come home. Let Professor Oda know what happened so he doesn't show up in the middle of a shitstorm offering to help with something.
He sighed heavily.
On your way out, tell Ramirez to come down here. I guess I start by breaking the news to him.
I hesitated. I had an instinct to go to him, but as if he sensed this, he made a waving away motion, like he was flicking something from his hand.
Go,
he repeated.
I'm sorry I dragged you into this. I'll be in touch when I can. Thanks for everything. Leave. Now.
He turned away from me. Diachronicle. Days 305 to 309. Early June, year 1. In which not all is lost, although in retrospect, perhaps it should have been. I shall skip over the miserable, dreadful limbo of the next few days. Suffice it to say, after alerting the professor and his wife of the tragic developments, I retreated to my third-floor walk-up and never went out except to buy groceries. I checked Facebook obsessively on the chance Erisabet would reach out to me that way. Nothing. I read the papers, actual and virtual. I ran Google searches. So what if they could trace me? They already knew who I was and where I lived. The dead Taltos in Hungary remained an established historical fact. Erisabet Karpaty, the asset, Schneider had called her, remained non-existent. I sniffed out possible job openings at universities so far below my pay grade that no prospective boss would bother contacting Blevins for a reference. And, although this sounds dramatic, I suppose I grieved. I had thrown myself, uncharacteristically, with such abandon into the most remarkable adventure of my regimented little life, had reshaped myself as a trailblazer alongside a man I realized was the most vital human being I'd ever known. And now it was all gone. The life, the trail, the trailblazing, the man. I was an unemployed academic with a disastrous employment history and nothing to offer the world but an uncanny facility with mostly dead and dying languages. Nothing I might ever do would come close to seizing my attention the same way. After what was easily the longest, most uncomfortable 4 or 5 days of my life, on an afternoon when I was so close to going mad that I began to re-alphabetize my vintage cookbook collection according to the Japanese syllabary, just to shut my brain up. The buzzer to my apartment blared. I almost jumped out of my skin. I went to the door.
"Who is it?"
I shouted into the intercom.
"Stokes!"
came a blessedly familiar voice through the crackle of crappy wiring. I shouted with relief as I buzzed him in. He bounded up the stairs, and as he neared me, I can't believe I did this, but I threw my arms around his neck and gave him an enormous hug.
"Tristan!"
I cried, and even planted a wet one, and even kissed his cheek.
"You're in one piece."
Almost equally surprising, he was hugging me back, and he being so much taller than I, by the time he reached the landing, he had hoisted me off the ground. He squeezed me hard and then released me.
"Better than one piece, even. Good to see you, Stokes."
"Where's Ersebet? What's happened?"
"She's fine. I'll explain. What do you have for beer? Those pencil pushers in D.C. all drink Bud Light."
He strode into the apartment.
"Missed you, Stokes."
He gestured grandly around the small room.
"This is where it all began. Someday, there'll be a plaque down front saying that."
"What's going on?" I demanded, opening the fridge. From the door, I took the last old tear sheet best bitter from the six-pack he'd brought up the first day we met. He took it from me, found the opener, and a moment later was seated happily on my couch. He patted the spot next to himself, and I sat.
"They were batshit insane happy about the diachronic effects," he said. "They're all about the time travel."
"But she killed someone," I said.
"That's why they're all about the time travel. It got results. General Schneider gets a star on the wall."
"Huh?"
"He has been declared a martyr for his country."
"How is that helpful? Are they going to trick our enemies into standing in an ODEC so Ersebet can send them to the moon?"
"See, what you and I were too freaked out to think about is that it's possible to get sent back in time and not end up dead," said Tristan. "It's actually possible to go back in time and do stuff. In fact, it may have happened already."
"What?" He sat up and took a big swig of his beer.
"The intel community has been noticing some inexplicable shit going on, but it's a little less inexplicable if it is the case that foreign powers are engaging in diachronic operations."
He gave me a moment to digest this. "Dodo," I said, "Department of Diachronic Operations. You've known all along, haven't you?"
"We have suspected. Now we know."
"Are you serious?" He nodded. "You mean there's another Ersebet out there?" He shrugged. "What exactly are you saying, Tristan?"
"Well..."
He sat up straighter, put the beer on the coffee table, rested his forearms on his knees, and looked at me.
"IARPA, the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency, which has been running this thing until now, thinks other countries might have, or might soon have, access to others like Ersebet. Somehow. Purely theoretical at this stage, but the time travel was new information, and all of a sudden, pieces started to fit together. So, in case certain other countries have found their own Ersebets and are sending people back in time to fiddle with things, the DNI doesn't want to see a magic gap opening up."
"DNI?"
"Director of National Intelligence, General Octavian Frink, reports directly to POTUS. The director of IARPA reports to Frink. General Schneider, God rest his soul, worked for a black budget arm of IARPA. And what has happened now, less than 24 hours ago, Stokes, is that Dodo has been bumped up the org chart. Now it's directly under General Frink, with a dotted line to Dr. Rudge at IARPA."
"Dotted line?"
"It just means Rudge is an advisor. We keep him in the loop."
"Who's we?"
"Well, I have been promoted to Lieutenant Colonel, and made the acting head of the Department of Diachronic Operations. I've been tasked with taking the ODEC and Ersebet to the next level, focusing entirely on time travel."
For a moment, I was so amazed by this reversal of fortune, I couldn't respond. Then, "Great. So, you're not in trouble?"
I'm not in trouble,
he said with a small, contented smile.
Wow, Tristan. I hooked one arm around his neck and gave him a side hug. He grinned, but took it a little stiffly. That's amazing. Ersebet's willing to cooperate? He rolled his eyes, but did not look too worried.
We're working on that. The asset likes to be pandered to by powerful men in suits. She likes Constantine Rudge because he wears cufflinks and went to Oxford, so I think I can chart a course.
Well then, congratulations. When do you start?
As soon as we can get ourselves to D.C. for the swearing-in.
You and Ersebet.
He gave me a funny look.
Stokes, we're going to be sending people back in time?
He jerked his left thumb over his shoulder, as if that's where back in time was.
Right, I got that.
So?
So what?
So who do you think is qualified to go back in time?
I shrugged. Athletes? Assassins? He was shaking his head. Historians?
Stokes!
He laughed.
Whoever goes has to be able to function in a setting where nobody speaks modern American English. We need polyglots and linguists.
We need, he pointed,
you.
I stared at him, eyes wide.
I bet my mouth dropped open, too.
I need you,
he added, realizing I was incapable of speech at that moment.
And I'm pretty sure you're otherwise unemployed.
Although safely seated, I suddenly felt so lightheaded, I put a hand on the coffee table to steady myself.
So what do you say?
He asked, with a comradely grin.
I can't promise you'll get to practice your conversational Sumerian, but you never know.
I felt like I was on the crest of a roller coaster, just about to plunge down a steep, joyfully terrifying thrill ride. I would have to be mad to agree to such a thing. You want to send me back in time? I heard myself say, not really sounding like myself.
Well, not permanently,
he said.
I'd miss you too much, Stokes.
God damn that grin of his. And he even roughed up my hair, the bastard. When do we leave? I asked.
Part 2.
Materializing was far more startling than any practice session we'd attempted in the ODEC, chiefly because not only was I, as usual, extremely disoriented and confused, but I landed completely naked. Outside. My balance wobbly, I felt warm grass and earth under my feet, and then collapsed at once sideways so that the smell of moist, sun-warmed soil filled my nostrils. I spent a few moments just breathing. Consciousness, the here and now of the human mind, is linked to the body's surroundings by a thousand strands, most of which we're never aware of until all of them are severed. The modern analogy would be to what happens when an errant backhoe slices through a fat underground cable, in an instant cutting off countless phone calls and internet connections. One's senses are always tracking sights, sounds, smells, and sensations. When a witch sends you, all of those are interrupted, and your mind doesn't know what to do with itself until it has knit itself into its new surroundings. It takes a minute. Sun, dappled by the branches of a tree, warmed my left side, as my right side felt the bumps of grass and earth, scattered twigs, knotty roots. As my consciousness knit itself into the new environment, I noticed an absence of the constant ambient noise of modern civilization. In its place was tremendous birdsong and the buzz of insects. A whizzing noise droned over me, barely overhead, like a huge insect, and terminated in a thunk. I looked over to see an arrow that had just embedded itself in the protruding root of a huge tree. Its fletchings of gray feathers were just a vibrating blur. It would have hit me if I hadn't toppled over. Immediately, the hazy sun was blocked by a tall figure looming over me. Naked, dizzy, and unarmed, I could not protect myself from him. Ersebet had just sent me to my death, as surely as she'd sent General Schneider. What fools we've been to think otherwise. He stepped directly over me, standing astride me, as if I were not there, his long robes covering my naked middle. A minister? A chieftain? But the figure shouted in a woman's voice, deep and stern.
Samuel, hunting is not for rabbits. You must trap them. We have told you so already. Save your arrows for the deer, and do not shoot them so close to my house.
A native English speaker, with a lilt almost Appalachian or Irish. A distant voice, a boy's, plaintive, giving her some back sass.
Samuel, you saw no such thing. It is your devilish fancy getting the better of you again. You are disobedient. Go into your mother.
A pause.
Go into your mother, I say. You may fetch your arrow back later. It is easy to find. In the root of the tree.
And then, a whisper in my direction.
Do not move until I tell you to.
And back up.
Samuel! Now!
A long pause as I began to collect my wits. Massachusetts Bay Colony, August 1640. The village of Muddy River, someday to be more attractively renamed Brookline. Yes, it was coming into focus now. Finally, the woman stepped back from me, and I could see her clearly. She was a Puritan, in a fitted dark blue top and long skirt, and a simple white cap. A large white collar covered her throat and shoulders. I had expected her to look like this, and yet seeing it was dizzying. She was not wearing a costume, she was simply wearing her clothes. I was here. It was happening. I would judge her to be about 40 years of age, but I knew her from our research to be closer to 30. She gave me a critical look.
"Why have you come?"
she demanded.
"This is no place for us. How thoughtless of you! To appear where anyone may see you or harm you. That arrow would hit you another time. And the boy saw you. You have made me a liar to say he didn't. If he calls us out, we'll both be hanged."
I'm sorry, Goody Fitch. I...
Stay down, she said,
completely unsurprised that I called her by name.
I will get something to cover you.
She turned and walked out of my view. I raised my head a little. The silence and birdsong continued their counterpoint, and in the distance now I could hear, and smell, a river. The still air had the clinging, heavy humidity of high summer. I was a stone's throw from a small wattle-and-daub house, with a thatched roof, a small door, but no windows on the back wall. 100 paces away in either direction, barely in view, were similar dwellings. The land had mostly been cleared, with big, axe-scarred tree stumps still protruding from tilled ground here and there. But a few huge old trees, too much effort to chop down, remained scattered about. I was beneath one such, a sugar maple. Behind the house was a fine, verdant kitchen garden, and beyond that, a forest, densely leafed, mostly oak, some pine. The boy whom Goody Fitch had scolded had been to the right of me. To the south, I realized, superimposing the map of Muddy River over what I could see. That meant it was the Griggs family. Samuel Griggs. The name was not familiar, but I hadn't memorized the whole village, just enough that I could passably seem to be familiar with it. Perhaps he would die before he reached maturity. It was a settlement of fewer than 200 souls. So, of course, I could not convince anyone that I belonged here. But these lots were large, 12 acres or more, and so it should have been easy to arrive unnoticed. That had been the intention. I was to arrive on the property of someone we believed to be a witch, out of sight of prying eyes. A fine scheme, if there were no complications.
Dear reader, there are always complications.
Every fucking... Every time. Goody Fitch returned with a thin, dun-colored woolen blanket and offered it down to me.
"Come inside quickly," she said. "We are about the same size. I will clothe you. And then you must leave quickly, in case Goody Griggs comes here, set on by her son."
A pause, as I gathered the blanket around my shoulders and carefully got to my feet. She did not offer a hand to assist, just stood watching me.
Evaluating.
But before you go, you will tell me why you are here.
I'm here on an... Her eyes flicked sideways, noticing some...